You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we speak with Margaret Flowers of PopularResistance.org and a candidate for U.S. Senator from Maryland about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the upcoming struggle to halt the global corporate coup in its tracks.
These large multinational agreements in the past, but it has happened by escalating our resistance and being willing to kind of nonviolently put pressure on them to show them that we are not going to tolerate this. It's going to have to take everything that we can do this coming fall to stop it.
Hello, I'm Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio, coming to you today from my home in the Dawnland. Kwe Inagwanu, welcome. Thank you for joining us. It's a breezy, breezy day here in the Northeast. In fact, we have no power. And I imagine that it's the remnants of the storms that hit the South coming up the coastline. So I'm happy to be able to be here with you today and to have this incredible conversation that we're going to have. And as always, I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry. And you may have no electricity, but you certainly have plenty of people power in terms of amplification of voice and getting the message out every week and in all the ways that you show up for the movements. And it's really quite thematic for our discussion today, since we'll be talking with another powerhouse of a woman, Margaret Flowers, who will introduce to you listeners in just a few moments. I want to acknowledge that today, as we're recording, is Indigenous Peoples Day, and it's a pretty interesting time this year. My own town where I live in Taos, New Mexico, has just declared Indigenous Peoples Day with the full support of the Taos Pueblo and the other two major groups, the Anglo and the Hispanic community here in Taos. So we're pretty excited about that. The state of Vermont declared the statewide Indigenous Peoples Day, which is very remarkable. And we're just seeing city after city, town after town, start to bring up this discussion, open the conversation, and oftentimes take powerful, effective action on shifting this and talking about why we shouldn't be celebrating Columbus, but rather taking a very different stance on our shared history together and how to move forward.
So I just came from an event here in Maine where we had a celebration of Indigenous Peoples Day in a city that has not yet changed the name of this holiday. And one of the things that we talked about was really unpacking this shared story that we have collectively been telling for a long, long time. As Indigenous people, we've always stood out against Columbus Day, recognizing that it was a celebration of genocide and conquest and slavery and rape and pillage and destruction of the land. And people are really starting to wake up to the fact that the stories that we tell actually shape the reality that we live. And when we have a story that glorifies a history of violence, when we have a story that glorifies the raping and killing of the women of an entire race of people, we have, you know, an easy correlation between those things and the things that are happening today. It's no wonder that there is such a history of violence in this country when the foundation of its origins are steeped in violence. And so if we want to be able to change the future, we have to be willing to change that story. And people are starting to change those stories that they're telling, and they're starting to recognize the correlation between those stories and the reality that we're living. So it's a hopeful time, and I'm encouraged. I'm going to be going right after the show to speak in another town, which has officially changed the name of the holiday to Indigenous Peoples Day, and acknowledge and honor their waking up to the reality that we all share in the framing of our future together.
It's so great that you're doing all that, Sherry, and just very heartened, you know, that it's a reminder that as people who work for change, we're visionaries, we're engaged in the struggle, and we do follow-up work to consistently maintain the community understanding, awareness that goes along with the reason why we had to push for change to begin with. This week on the show, we're going to speak with another, as we said, powerful change maker, Margaret Flowers. She is a doctor, a medical doctor originally, but now she doctors for the people and the planet using nonviolent struggle and organizing. She is the co-host of Clearing the Fog Radio, the co-founder of PopularResistance.org, an amazing movement journal. And she is also running for U.S. Senator from Maryland. We wanted to bring her on the show today to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the struggle that's going on to stop these, what I like to call, nefarious trade deals. I'm a bit opinionated on the subject. And her journal, Popular Resistance, is helping to organize the Flush the TPP campaign, and they're about to launch in 1 month a No Lame Duck Uprising to stop the passing of this trade deal during the lame duck session. So welcome to the show, Margaret. Thank you for taking time with us today. We feel quite honored because we know how busy your schedule is.
I've had the honor of being with you and also with Jill Stein a couple of times in the last several years to discuss some of these issues that we're all dealing with in our communities. And I think that it's really important for people to understand how our recent history is actually connected to our outspokenness and our resistance to the TPP, TISA, and the TTIP, and how trade deals of the past have actually created this gutting of the middle class and how it's impacted the lives of people on the ground. Can you give us a little bit of that history and then lead us into what we're facing now with these new wave of trade deals?
So the history of these so-called free trade agreements in the United States and the Trans-Pacific Partnership is along that same model. Started back in the 1990s with the first one, the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, which was between the United States, Mexico, and Canada. And one of the things that NAFTA did is it really opened up the kind of floodgates for the United States to bring subsidized agricultural products like corn into the Mexican economy, which is already a heavily corn-based economy. And because our products were so heavily subsidized by the government, our corn prices were very low, and farmers in Mexico were not able to survive and grow corn off, you know, at that very, very low price. And so it really devastated much of the Mexican agricultural sector and then drove people into the cities where, you know, then there's competition for jobs there, and it really opened up the door for big agricultural companies, corporations to buy up and grab up the land and then put in factory farms. So it really had a tremendous impact on our food industry as well as on the Mexican economy and the people of Mexico. And then it created this trade tribunal, or this kind of court system that operates outside of our court system that allows corporations to sue our governments if we pass laws that interfere with their profits. So people who are familiar with the Keystone XL pipeline fight may know that TransCanada, the company that wanted to build that, is now suing the United States under NAFTA for $15 billion since we did not permit the northern leg. And overall, if we look at, you know, there have been numerous trade agreements, large ones and ones just between country to country over the past 20-something years, we see that overall these agreements increase the trade deficit and they drive down wages and worker protections and even environmental protections, because any kinds of environmental rules or labor rules that are written into these agreements are not enforced. And in fact, under the Trans-Pacific Partnership, they don't even put in rules. It's the weakest, most vague standards that we've seen in any agreement. It's more like, we should aspire to consider the environment as we go forward, but nothing that's enforceable in any way. So we're very concerned about the impact that these agreements have overall in driving this global race to the bottom and further empowering more and more, thousands more multinational corporations to have the right to prevent us from passing laws to protect our communities and the planet.
I guess that's the rub, really, for me, is this whole idea that we're seeing more and more the attempts of the mega corporations, especially, to say we can do whatever we want, and you really can't do anything about it. For me, it's personally insulting as a human being to think that our governments are just rolling over and cooperating with this. And that's really what we've been seeing. Can you speak a little bit about the resistance to the TPP and the TTIP and or the cooperation and the facilitation of getting this through our Congress and what's going on in the international arena?
Sure, thank you. So there are three agreements underway right now. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership is between 12 Pacific Rim countries. The Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, is between the United States and the European Union. And then there's an even larger one called the Trade and Services Agreement, or TISA, which is more than 50 countries and involves driving privatization of services, which are 80% of our economy. So think education, healthcare, the post office, water, et cetera. And so when we saw that the Trans-Pacific Partnership was being negotiated, and it's the one that's farthest along, they've completed the negotiations. The country signed it on February 4th of this year, and it has to be ratified within 2 years to go into effect. We saw this both as something that must be stopped because it impacts everything. It impacts the food that we eat, you know, the environment, worker rights, internet freedom, the cost of healthcare, just goes on and on. It would set back the work that we're doing in our communities to try to lift up and protect our communities. But it also is kind of a struggle that unites us because it has that broad impact. And so we've often talked about the need to create a movement of movements and to bring people together to fight together strategically for the changes we need. And this was one such opportunity. And so over the past 5 years, that movement has really grown tremendously. President Obama was trying to pass something called Fast Track, which would give him the authority to sign the agreement before Congress saw it and would create a process that would allow him to kind of push it through Congress without amendments or much debate and having to have an up or down vote in a short period of time. And the movement of movements kept that off for years. For 3 years, we stalled Congress from giving that, you know, passing that piece of legislation. And it was finally when the negotiations broke down and the president couldn't proceed without it, that the whole industry, the Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, all of these multinational corporations that won it really came down very heavily and had to twist arms in Congress and just barely squeaked that through. In fact, we defeated it in the House, and then they did what they often do. They tacked it on to another piece of legislation, a pension bill that nobody would want to vote against, and brought it back up again. And what we see in Europe is really amazing, because when they do protests, you know, in Brussels, in Germany, against this, they turn out hundreds of thousands of people. And we see farmers coming into town, and they bring their trucks and their hay and their manure, and they jam up the streets and spray manure at the federal buildings. And it's, you know, really have a very strong resistance. And so they have been able to hold off the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. And it's really critical that here in the United States, we are the country of the 12 countries involved in the TPP. We are the key country to stopping it. If we can prevent the ratification of the TPP this fall in Congress after the election, then that will really go a long way to showing our popular power against these multinational corporations and put a real chill on the other agreements as well.
Margaret, another area that is not often talked about is the correlation between the violation of indigenous rights and the negotiation of these trade deals. One of the things that has happened recently is that the UN has come out stating that the Trans-Pacific Partnership, better known as TPP, as you've said, is a serious threat to indigenous land rights, as well as to the natural resources that indigenous peoples work to preserve. There is pretty significant, how should I put it, possibility that the TPP is going to grant greater rights to transnational firms, often at the expense of indigenous peoples' rights, and that the rights of indigenous peoples to their lands and their waterways are oftentimes not protected, even though there are laws in place to protect them. They're not protected by these nation states where these lands are located. Here in the United States, we've seen the largest increase in attacks against indigenous rights in recent years that we've seen in over 100 years. And many people connect that to the rise in power of these transnational corporations and also to the anticipation of the TPP being signed, because if you're unable to cross these lands because of the protections that are in place and the obligation that the United States has, the trust obligation that the United States has to Indigenous peoples, if you're not able to cross these lands unobstructed, then it certainly is going to be an impediment to your profitability if you're one of these big transnational corporations. So there's been this attempted dismantling of Indigenous rights that has kind of preceded the TPP. Do you know much about that issue, or how much that comes into play in the decision making that local and national governments are engaged in regard to the protection of Indigenous rights?
It's a very concerning area for a number of reasons. One is that in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, they are basically removing any barriers to patenting anything. So including patenting seeds, patenting plants, patenting animals, things that we consider to be part of nature and not something that should be commodified and marketized. Multinational corporations can sue if we try to prevent them from patenting these things. And then once they patent them, they do have control over them. So that's a concern for everyone, but also particularly for Indigenous communities. And then just the kind of threat to sovereignty in terms of giving multinational corporations the right to sue our governments if we try to prevent them from doing what they want. So if they are planning to frack an area and then we try to say, no, you know, you can't do this or that, then they can sue in this international court over that being an interference with their profit. So I guess I could speak to it from that perspective. I know that you as an Indigenous lawyer are much more informed about this area than I am. But it's certainly, I think, being also involved in the climate justice movement and seeing also an increase in the willingness of government to use eminent domain in a very militarized and aggressive way to serve the interests of, in particular, the fossil fuel industry and other extractive industries is very concerning and something that the TPP, I think, will only worsen.
One of the things that's concerning, and every time I talk with Sherry about this issue of Indigenous land rights, water rights being infringed upon by the growing corporate state, the transnational global corporate state, as a new body politic that's been emerging over the past 150, 200 years to an extreme concentration of wealth and power now, today, is that Sherry's perspective on Indigenous people and their need to protect their rights, their land, their water, their culture, it always makes me reflect as a white American, like, what are we doing on that score as well? I mean, these are oftentimes corporations that are very deeply entwined with what we consider to be our representative republic or our government that's supposed to be representing us. But at the end of the day, we are seeing over and over again that our rights as citizens are not any more prized or valued or protected than those in Indigenous nations, although there is a scale to who gets protected in this country. And generally, the more white and wealthy you are, the more protection you get from the oligarchs and the corporate state. Or at least that's my layperson's estimation about what's going on in our country right now. And when it comes down to it, you know, the TPP and the TTIP are really bringing up very deep questions about, as you said, sovereignty. Like, whose government is this? Who is the highest law of the land? Whose rights are protected? So my question for you, Margaret, is where does the TPP and the TTIP fall in terms of what I might call the global corporate coup? It seems to me like this is a gravy train for the corporations. And is this like a tipping point of no return? I mean, what happens if these trade deals actually do get passed? How much worse off does our world get in terms of we the people having any rights or power at all?
Right. That's why this is such a fundamental struggle for us, because we see that kind of the fundamental issue of our era is the corporate power versus popular power. And you know, we see the Trans-Pacific Partnership and TTIP and PISA as really kind of a workaround the World Trade Organization since the Battle of Seattle in 1999 and other struggles, resistance against the WTO's agenda when they meet around the world. The WTO has really been stalled. And so they were looking for an avenue to try to get the provisions that they wanted outside of that. And if you look at these agreements and the fact that they are open-ended, that more countries can join onto them after they've been completed, which is completely unheard of in the past, these agreements can eventually encircle the whole world. And they were negotiated in a way that was very different from past trade negotiations. They were done in secret. They were classified. And so while corporate lawyers had access to the text and could advise and help write it, our own members of Congress had very limited access. They had to go through a special process to request it. It took months. Then they had to go into a special room in the Capitol to read it. They were not allowed to bring in a pen or paper, a camera, a recorder, or a staff member with them. They couldn't talk about specifics of what they read. But some of them told us that all they got to read were redacted portions of the text or summaries of the chapters. So they weren't even seeing the full text of the document. So this is really a different and very secretive process that's been used to get these provisions that corporations want, and they could never get through the front door of Congress, snuck in through the back door. So these things like the patent protection or weakening the protections of the planet and workers' rights. And it is a kind of an irreversible thing. If we ratify these agreements, it's next to impossible to go back, and particularly under something like the Trade and Services Agreement, which is going to be driving privatization, including privatization of things like water. Once they're privatized, it's almost impossible for us to go back and reverse that. So this will really further consolidate corporate power. It also has opened up this whole new area where they've included the financial sector, and so that the financial corporations can now sue our government if we try to put more regulations in place to prevent them from preying on our economy or crashing our economy. And we're seeing this whole new kind of industry grow up of corporations that buy companies in other countries specifically with the intention of finding an opportunity to sue the government so that they can make money off of it. Not even to set up a business there, but just to look at it as an opportunity to sue in this court system and make some money. So this is really a very concerning direction, and it's why we are taking this struggle so seriously.
I think it's really important for people to understand that piece of it. I often call these trade agreements the triumphant return of feudalism, that people are really kind of unaware of the broad reach that these trade agreements have. And the threat of the ISDS, the investor state dispute settlement provisions within the TPP, pose an incredible risk and an incredible harm to those who are defending the land, water. But it's not just the land and water, but also agriculture, fishing economies, the preservation of our vital ecosystems, preservation of access to information on the internet, through internet restrictions, the ability to be able to grow food in our backyards. All of these things are at stake. But not only that, but nation-state sovereignty is at stake. The sovereignty of local municipalities is at stake. The TPP gives multinational corporations more power than even our elected officials, removing judiciary powers from local and national governing bodies and transferring them to this investor-state dispute settlement structure. And so when we start thinking about the broad reach of this, about the fact that not only does it have these devastating impacts on the earth and on our local economies, but it also has a complete dismantling effect on our democracy. And the depth of that is staggering. Can you talk a little bit about the broad implications of the removal of power from our elected officials, the removal of power from our local judiciaries in being able to resolve disputes under this? Because I think that's really important.
Right. It is. It's fundamental. And it's something that, you know, more and more people are talking about now, fortunately. But basically, through this investor state dispute process, a corporation can sue a government in this international trade tribunal if a law is passed that interferes with their profits in any way. And the trade tribunal is staffed by three so-called judges. Oftentimes, they're lawyers who are on leave from their corporate lawyers on leave from their job. who serve as judges because they're considered to be experts in their field, they can make a legal decision or set a legal precedent when they serve as a judge in the trade tribunal. And then after that case is finished, go back to the corporation they work for and use that legal precedent for another case that would actually benefit the company that they work for. It's a very rigged process. At the same time, our government or we as people, our communities, do not have the right to sue corporations in this court system if they harm us. And the decision that's made, it's like an arbitration court. The decision they make is final. We can't appeal it. We can't rehear it in our own judicial system here in the United States. So it really is a cementing of kind of that corporate power. And the impact that this has then on our own legislative system is that governments at any level are less inclined to pass laws that may interfere with corporate profits because then they enter into these very lengthy and extensive lawsuits with them. For instance, Australia was sued by Philip Morris because they wanted to put packaging on their cigarettes that warned people about the dangers of smoking, and this interfered with Philip Morris's ability to sell more cigarettes. It cost the Australian government $50 million to have that court case. And they actually, in a rare instance, they were able to win that case. But most of the time, these cases are decided in favor of the corporation. So it also has a very chilling impact, as well as through the TPP and TTIP, they're giving greater access to corporations to be notified of the intention to pass laws that may interfere with them. So that's part of the regulatory cooperation environment that is created by these agreements.
So, I mean, any sensible human being at this point has shivers and chills going down their back and is just ready to pull out their hair in frustration over this whole thing. I hope all of our listeners are feeling that same feeling with me right now. And it's important to remember that every dollar that goes to fighting these lawsuits or paying out to the corporations when they win a lawsuit is all money coming that's coming out of our pockets, ultimately. It's coming out of our schools for our children, our roads that we drive on, our services that we need in our communities, our public libraries. I mean, it's not like the money just grows on trees. It's our tax dollars. So, I mean, there's just so much about these trade deals, which is, I mean, I just feel outraged about it every time I hear about it. Now, one of the things, Margaret, that I read about in the Flush the TPP newsletter and also on Popular Resistance's newsletter is that the key thing about TPP and TTIP and TISA is not that people are just complacently going along about with this, but more that people don't know about it, that they're not aware of what is going on. I mean, we're all concerned about Russia being aggressive, which is a little bit of a complete misnomer. We're actually being much more aggressive towards Russia than they are towards us. But the real threat to our sovereignty and our rights as people and our way of life, quote unquote, as Americans, is really coming from within our own corporate state with these trade deals. And of course, most people aren't aware of them. So my question is really, once people know and they're feeling like I am, this sense of outrage and incenseness about it, what do they do? What can we do?
Absolutely. And it's interesting because there was a real media blackout on the TPP. When we first started organizing around this, we could not get commercial media to cover it. And now we see actually a big push of propaganda where the Chamber of Commerce and other big business or interests are putting op-eds into papers all over the country that they write to try to, you know, expound on the virtues of the TPP that are non-existent. But we were able to get around that media blackout and reach people using social media, independent media, alternative media, and that was very successful. A recent poll showed that while only 30% of people in the United States are aware of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, super majorities of them are opposed to it and don't want it to be considered in the congressional session after the elections when members of Congress are not accountable. It's called the lame duck. And so we're doing a good job in terms of the people that we do reach in educating them about the harms of this agreement.
And we'll return to speaking with Margaret Flowers after a quick break for a station ID. let's return to speaking with Margaret Flowers about the growing resistance to the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
We also have to recognize that because of the resistance, both in the United States, but also in solidarity with people in other countries all around the world, for instance, on the day that the agreement was signed on February 4th, there were actions in 65 cities in 7 countries around the world that day that we, you know, worked together to show our opposition to this agreement. And we've pushed the ratification of the Trans-Pacific Partnership into an election year, something that President Obama did not want to do. And we made the TPP politically unpalatable so that the vast majority of presidential candidates are either outright against it, as Dr. Jill Stein has been consistently, or they're saying that they're against it, as we hear from Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. The only candidate who's openly for it is the libertarian Gary Johnson. And many members of Congress that are up for re-election are unwilling to say that they're in favor of it. They're using this language of "I'm against it as it's currently written." So this was a huge victory for the movement. So we have to recognize that we do have power, and we have had an impact already. But once we're expecting that the White House will introduce legislation in Congress on November 14th, the first day that members of Congress come home. And so we've been organizing throughout the year to put that kind of week on people's radar and their calendar. And we're holding a direct action training and then 4 days of action in Washington, D.C. to greet Congress when they come back on the 14th. So the camp starts on the night of November 12th, and then actions will run through the 14th to the 17th while members are in D.C. because we're going to have to really come together in large numbers, show our opposition to this, show them that the people are paying attention, are aware that we're not going to allow them to do that. And then for people who are not able to travel to D.C. to participate in those actions, that's a week that people can be calling in to their members of Congress, writing letters to them, sending in emails, just really showing them the massive opposition to this. Then when members of Congress go home on the 17th, we're asking people to consider holding actions in their own districts when the members are home during the Thanksgiving break. So that would be Monday through Wednesday, November 21st through the 23rd would be a great time for people to go to their members' offices locally and express their opposition to this agreement. We've stopped these large multinational agreements in the past, but it has happened by escalating our resistance and being willing to kind of nonviolently put pressure on them to show them that we are not going to tolerate this. It's going to have to take everything that we can do this coming fall to stop it.
There are a number of other concerns that I have with the TPP that I know have been discussed quite a bit within circles of people that are actually talking about it, that are aware of it. One of those areas relates to labor laws, that there's a great concern about the protection of workers around the world under this agreement. There's a side agreement between the U.S., Malaysia, Brunei, and Vietnam about maintaining consistent labor standards. However, there have been no agreements with other signatory countries, and some of those have had questionable labor standards, such as Mexico and Peru. And under the TPP, unions, labor advocacy groups, trade federations could lobby or petition the U.S. or other governments to take formal actions to enforce those provisions, but they aren't able to file a complaint under the agreement. So again, we're losing this hard-earned protection for workers and for labor rights under this agreement, that people aren't going to have access to recourse under this. That's one big concern. The second big concern is related to health and the availability of medication. As you talked about, the intellectual property chapter of the TPP will enhance or extend patent and copyright protections for medicines as well as other things, which in turn will lead to higher healthcare costs, and that it will obligate most member countries to extend their existing patent monopolies and lengthen the time between when a drug is discovered and more affordable generic drugs are able to come onto the market. And it also mandates that governments restrict competitor generic drug producers and regulatory authorities from using existing clinical data on biological medicine safety and efficacy, even in the absence of patents. So you have all of these things that are taking away these really hard-won rights and protections that people have put in place over long periods of time. They're just going to evaporate under this trade agreement. Can you talk a little bit about the implications in regard to labor law and also the access to medicine under this agreement? Because that is really about the health and safety and the well-being of the people living on the ground.
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. We know that the Colombia Free Trade Agreement was hailed as an agreement that was supposed to have very strong worker protections in it. But in fact, those worker protections have not been enforced, and the attack on union leaders continues to occur in Colombia. The Trans-Pacific Partnership didn't even go very far in even saying that they were going to have strong labor protections in it. There's no real enforceable labor protections in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And really, we see this as driving kind of a global race to the bottom, as it allows multinational corporations to move around the planet. And actually, the TPP allows capital to flow between countries more easily. And this puts kind of I think of it as kind of blackmail, or I'm not sure what the term would be, extortion of countries, where if a country is not acting in a way that's favorable to the corporation, they can just threaten to leave or threaten to pull their capital out of that country and have a huge impact on the economy. So we are concerned that globally this is going to drive a race to the bottom in wages and worker protections. When it comes to healthcare, all the things that you said about the patenting and the obstacles to creating generics are absolutely going to have an impact on keeping our health, our pharmaceutical and medical device prices high. They also gave greater legal standing to pharmaceutical and medical device industries to challenge when a government health system negotiates for what they consider to be a fair price for that, that they can challenge and force them to pay more of what they call a market price and help pay for the advertising and other things that corporation does. So it's going to have an impact on countries that have health systems in terms of costing them more, and so then requiring them to perhaps have to cut back on the services that they can provide and stay within their budget. And also the Trans-Pacific Partnership goes after what are called state-owned enterprises. So any entity that gets any kind of benefit from the state, maybe it's a tax advantage or access to capital, would not be able to have that advantage unless private multinational corporations that want to operate get the same advantage. So it really is going to undermine efforts to try to create public institutions that serve the public. And this is a big concern, especially for me as someone who's been fighting for improved Medicare for All for a long time, a single payer healthcare system. We're concerned that these agreements will prevent us from being able to create a single payer healthcare system in our country.
So just so our listeners remember, November 12th through 17th is DC Actions. And then over the Thanksgiving break, when your senators and representatives return home to your communities, show up and let them know thanks, but no thanks. We don't want the TPP is an option for everyone who's listening. A question I have for you, Margaret, you brought up Gary Johnson as some of the libertarian candidate for president who is in favor of the TPP, which really made me wonder, you know, people who are in favor of the TPP, what's their angle on this? Why do they think this is such a great thing? Are they into the jobs? This is going to be great for the economy. And who are they? Who, besides the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who is a pretty obvious culprit around this, and the mega corporations, who else is in support of it? And then who is aligned against it? I would imagine that there are not so large corporations who know that this is a death knell for them, that these kind of treaties are going to favor the already huge and powerful at the expense of small startups, small businesses, mid-sized businesses, regional businesses, local economies. What do we have aligned on the two sides of this equation, and why might some people be for it?
Right. Thank you. So I think when it comes to someone like Gary Johnson, it's just an ideology that they believe in the so-called free market. Libertarians tend to do that, although you would think that they would see this as an agreement that empowers crony capitalism, which is something that they're against. The forces that are mainly behind it are, you know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, the very large multinational corporations, financial institutions that will be able to use this agreement to extract more profit. And on the flip side, we have the groups that are opposing it, are small and medium-sized businesses, as you mentioned. Just recently, there was a letter that was sent to members of Congress by the American Sustainable Business Council, as well as the Coalition for a Prosperous America, which is a more conservative group of businesses, because it is the small and medium-sized businesses that get hurt. We also see that our small and medium-sized farms and food industries have sent letters to Congress because they will also be hurt by an agreement like this. It favors big ag and industrialized agriculture more than our small, you know, family and medium-sized family farms. And then it's what's been amazing is how this movement of movements against the TPP has really such breadth and depth. And if you go to our website, flushthetpp.org, and look at the No Lame Duck, it's flushthetpp.org/no-lame-duck, you'll see the 200 organizations that have endorsed the No Lame Duck actions. And it's groups that care about the right to know what's in your food, like the anti-GMO groups, it's healthcare groups, it's the internet freedom organizations, labor organizations, Public Banking Institute has come out and endorsed. So there's just a whole broad range, as well as faith-based organizations as well, who are concerned, and human rights concerned organizations that have signed on. And one thing, if I could just share, I was able to be privy to a conversation by some Washington lobbyist committee members and some other, the U.S. trade representatives were there as well. And to hear the way that they talked about these things, they were saying, oh, well, you know, people want to start putting considering sustainability in the legislation that they have, and that's going to be a problem. That's going to interfere with us. People are concerned about the food they're feeding their children, and we can't allow them to put that into law because that will prevent us from being able to make our profits. And the most egregious was one where they said that in the past, with trade agreements, when a country was undergoing a crisis, they could get an exemption so that they were not required to export a certain amount of food. So say that there's a drought or some sort of agricultural crisis going on, and the country doesn't make as much rice as it needs and wants to hang on to that. Under the TPP, they would be forced to continue to meet their export quotas, even in a crisis situation. This is how little they care about the health and well-being of people on our planet.
There are so many concerning provisions within the TPP that it's impossible for us to cover them all in this one show today. We have talked about it in the past, and we're happy for this opportunity to continue this discussion in such a thorough, clear, and concise way. Many of our listeners access our program online. There are a number of things within the TPP's intellectual property chapter that should be of great concern to us all. There are a number of problematic features in that chapter that actually undermine online freedom of expression. There is a requirement to put in place mechanisms to enforce the rights of copyright holders, but these mechanisms do nothing to adequately protect freedom of expression and other rights, leaving considerable room for politically motivated abuses of this system. For example, member countries will be required to permit copyright holders to compel internet companies to take down online content that allegedly infringes copyright without any prior judicial or other independent determination or oversight. And this could allow political actors to abuse the system by alleging copyright infringements in order to censor dissenting voices. It also omits many of the safeguards that currently are in place in U.S. law that are designed to protect the rights of users against those particular types of abuses, such as the U.S. law requires internet companies to restore content if the user who posted it objects under certain circumstances. That safeguard is not required under the TPP. The U.S. law also provides exceptions for fair use of copyrighted materials for such things as the news, commentary, criticism, parody, for doing independent research. None of this is required under the TPP. And, you know, these concerns about abuse are not theoretical. There actually have been documented instances where governments and powerful private actors have abused similar laws in the past, the DCMA, to silence criticism. In Ecuador, authorities used U.S. copyright law to take down videos documenting police abuse or criticizing government policy from social media sites. So there's a real powerful potential for censorship and for eliminating access to information for people as a result of the TPP, and that has an incredible reach over our ability to be able to manage the information that we receive, but also to have access to information that is going to help to, you know, determine the decisions that we make on a day-to-day basis. Everything that we're going to be fed is going to be controlled by corporations, the media, the social media, all of these different outlets that we've formulated because of the hijacking of the mainstream media, all of the things that people have done to create a source, an outlet for creative expression, for alternative voices, could be taken away from us under the TPP. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you for bringing all of those pieces up. The internet has actually become kind of the last area where we have a truly kind of open and democratized access to information and can share information with others, you know, locally and globally. And it's become a very critical tool in our daily lives, and especially, as you said, in our activism, to be able to organize and express dissent. And so it is concerning, you know, what can be done under the Trans-Pacific Partnership, where internet service providers are actually turned into police who will be monitoring and policing our content in the interests of private corporate interests. And it's interesting because just last night we experienced some difficulties, and I don't think we know quite yet exactly what the cause was, but it almost felt like, wow, is this what it's going to be like when we, in this kind of direction that we're turning, where corporations have more control over our access to information. I know Dr. Jill Stein was trying to do a debate response during the presidential debate with Democracy Now! She had done one on her own, the first presidential debate, and was able to reach 15 million people. And so one may expect that the corporate elites or the power elites are not interested in letting her reach that many people. And so all day long, her social media was throttled, and then there were all kinds of technical difficulties that arose during the night that prevented her from really being able to have an effective response to the presidential so-called debate that happened. So this is what we're talking about, you know, in this direction that we're going, is that it's going to impede on our abilities to be able to communicate and get accurate information in the future.
Well, I think we're already seeing that impeding on getting accurate information, since this was a trade deal negotiated wholly in secret, and even our congressional representatives were not given access to it for a long time, and then given very limited access to it, as you mentioned on the show. You know, it's very concerning. It's very alarming. It's another turn in the rise of the corporate coup. It's something that I myself am very much against, the direction that our country and our world is going in terms of corporate state power. I think it spells bad news for living, breathing, loving, living human beings. I wanted to ask you, though, Margaret, in our last few minutes of the show, a question that kind of takes a tack in a different direction, but is still very related. Now, you are running as a senator for the U.S., the federal level Congress, from the state of Maryland. You're also an activist at the same time. So your take on the entire web of social and political issues is informed by your on-the-ground work and also your commitment to using whatever platform is going to advance the cause of the people. I'd like to just hear from you. We did a show last week on women and democracy, and here you are, a woman in democracy, running both in the political system and using your political power within the movement of movements to make change. Just what is your take on what's going on in terms of this electoral race that you're engaged in and the work that's ahead of us in terms of democracy? As we've just mentioned, this battle over the TPP and the TTIP is very much a part of the demise of democracy, I would say. But beyond the scope of just that, what's your take on what we should all be aware of in terms of democracy and our challenges?
Well, thank you. Yes, so I'm running as a Green Party candidate for U.S. Senate in Maryland. I'm on the ballot. And the experience of running has shown me firsthand how the commercial media and the system is designed to exclude our voices and prevent people from knowing that they have other choices. I view the electoral work that I'm engaged in now, which I didn't, you know, see myself before doing, but I see it as an extension of the social movement work. If we look at how social transformation has traditionally occurred. It's happened through the rise of social movements and then eventually also alternative parties that build the political power to get into office or even to just impact the agenda of those in office, to be that expression of the movement. And our work at Popular Resistance has been to promote kind of a two-prong approach of both resisting harmful policies and practices, but also beginning to put in place what we would like to see. And so I see this as really fundamental right now, that we have two political parties, the Democrats and Republicans, that are dominated by wealth. They have shown, you know, no regard for the health and safety of people and the planet. And we have academic studies now that show us that our public policies overwhelmingly benefit the wealthy. We can't change that system by continuing to vote for it. We don't stop plutocracy by voting for the plutocrats. We have to build up the alternative. And the Green Party, for me, is a party that is based, it's rooted in four pillars of nonviolence, social justice, sustainability, and grassroots democracy. So what's been interesting for me this year, running for statewide office, is that in Maryland, we also have 12 other candidates who are running either for Congress, or we have a mayoral candidate in Baltimore and some city council candidates, and that we're really working together to lift up each other's campaigns and to build a strong infrastructure and a strong alternative in our state. And of course, we talk to Greens in other states as well and try to support them. But to get people who are coming out of impacted communities and are active in standing up for those communities to be the people that are running for office so that they can continue to bring that perspective into office and to continue to bring people in, their voices in, and to push for policies that benefit us. So, you know, no matter what happens November 8th, the election day, we are going to be continuing to build that infrastructure, run candidates, and build up the party, knowing that it takes decades sometimes before we actually win in significant numbers. But we do know that, you know, already there's more than 100 Green Party candidates who have been elected and are sitting in office right now, and over 1,000 that have been elected over the couple of decades that the Green Party has been around. But this is just a fundamental other way that we need to build popular political power. And, you know, and we're having some successes. I was excluded initially from the debates and have had to push back, and people who support my campaign have been pushing back on that. And just this weekend, I was able to be in my first three-way debate with the other two Senate candidates, the first time that we could go head-to-head. And so it's also, it was a platform for people to see how fundamentally we different we are than the other two corporate parties. So part of the necessary work, and it's a struggle, you know, every step of the way.
I think it's also really important to note that the folks that are out there sounding the alarm right now about the two-party system aren't the first ones to have done it. John Adams right. said that there is nothing which I dread so much as a division of the republic into two great parties, each arranged under its leader and concerting measures in opposition to each other. This, in my humble apprehension, is to be dreaded as the greatest political evil under our Constitution. And so when we think about what has happened and what has transpired, the founders were actually talking about this and warning against it from the very beginning. And now we're seeing the impacts of that roll out in our daily lives across our television screens and, in fact, the way that we actually are forced to live our lives in this country. The division and the vitriol that has resulted from this divisive politics, this complete suppression of true democracy or even any form of true representative democracy, has been devastating. The impacts on our unity within this country have been kind of tumbled as a result of this posturing for power that has resulted between these two parties that actually have very little difference between them. I mean, there's all being driven by the same moneyed interest and at the end of the day, by the same sense of value that's based on capitalist promotion and on industrial promotion and on the expansion of the corporatocracy. And so we've seen how it has severed the American dream. And we need to start thinking about what was the original vision and how were we warned against the very real dangers that we're facing today, and how can we shift that and change that? And the way to do that is to open up the debates, open up the elections, and allow for the people to have true voice and true choice. The last thing that I want to say to you is that what really strikes me when I meet these powerful women that are doing this work out there is that there are a number of them who have come from the medical industry. And so these are people who were drawn to heal the population. And they're now coming out and they're working on healing the population in really deep, fundamental ways within the social structure. And I want to acknowledge your role in doing that work and thank you for coming forward to do that work. As Rivera said, we talked last week on the show about the need for true feminine power to come forward, which is the nurturing, protecting, and sustaining of life. And I know that both you and Dr. Jill Stein have dedicated your lives to protecting, nurturing, and sustaining life. You did that as medical doctors, and now you're out there doing that in the world in very real ways. So I want to honor and acknowledge your contributions. I really appreciate everything that you guys are doing. So thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. And I appreciate your work and Rivera's work as well, because I know that you, Sherry, are using your legal skills to protect communities and to protect the planet. And Rivera, your work to educate people about nonviolent resistance and how we can rise together to really change the world is crucial. So I think it's an interesting time, and it gives me hope when I see so many people who are rising up and taking action. And I think that we can really make the changes that we want to see.
Well, thank you, Margaret, for not just being a part of that movement of movements, but for being such a fosterer and fomenter of the movement of movements. It's an honor to have you on Love and Revolution Radio this week, and we hope to have you back again soon. Thanks this week to our guest, Margaret Flowers. You can find the campaign to stop the trade deals we've been talking about at flushthetpp.org, and you can also follow news of the movement of movements at popularresistance.org. Thanks this week to my legally astute and heart-centered co-host, Sherry Mitchell. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find her music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And thank you to you, my magnificent co-host, Mr. Vera Sun, for your ability to meaningfully engage all of these diverse subjects that we discuss on the show with some real depth and understanding. And I'm honored to be able to share the airwaves with you. If you've enjoyed some of the things that I share on the show, you can also check out my Facebook page, Sacred Instructions, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. Love and Revolution is a weekly radio program, and your local radio station can broadcast it. All you have to do is give them a call and ask them. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera Sun's website, www.riverasun.com. And we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. Well, listeners, the corporate state has been busy usurping our human sovereignty, not to mention our national sovereignty, with their trio of trade deals as part of a long legacy of this slow, creeping corporate coup. So maybe you'll check out how to participate in the No Lame Duck Uprising to flush the DPP by the time we talk to you next week.